The next speaker is Rosamund Bartlett. Rosamund has held several academic positions in the UK, where she's based. She's published a number of books on Russian literature and music, biographies of Chekhov and Tolstoy, a study of Wagner's influence on Russian thought, the Cambridge Companion to Russian Music, an edited volume, a further edited volume on Shostakovich in context, etc. And in addition, she's translated two volumes of Chekhov stories, one for Oxford World's Classics, one for Hesperus, and most recently Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, due out later this year, and also in the Oxford World's Classics series. And she's going to talk about translating Tolstoy.
Rosamund.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here to move to a very, very different subject. And while we were having the discussion, I was thinking about target audiences, actually, because it is a very, very relevant question. And if you're translating something for a press like Oxford World's Classics, you do have to think about that, because your work is going to be read in Europe and in the United States and indeed all around the world. And I was very conscious in doing my translation of Anna Karenina in not being too British. As you can hear, I'm English, and I'm grateful for having lived in the States for a few years that I'm slightly aware of what a Britishism is. And in general, a lot of Russian literature is translated traditionally in the 20th century in a rather English way, and it's something that you have to be conscious of to try and be a little bit more universal. I'm going to try and talk about general things about Tolstoy's style and make some reference to Chekhov, because the whole experience of translating Tolstoy for me has made me think about my earlier experience translating Chekhov, his young contemporary. It's made me think again about Chekhov's prose, because you really do get to know a writer very, very well when you translate them, as we all will know. And the experience has also made me think about Tolstoy differently too, actually. We're looking at the famous portrait that Kramskoy painted in 1873, when Tolstoy was just about to begin his second great novel. He didn't really want to sit for the portrait, but Kramskoy turned up on his doorstep and knocked on the door and talked him into it. And that's another story. It belongs in the Tretyakov gallery now. It's quite interesting that he's wearing his typical peasant smock, which is of relevance to the whole question of translating Anna Karenina, because the whole stance that Tolstoy was developing in the 1870s was one in which he was moving increasingly away from being a writer who wrote for the pampered, educated elite. I also wanted to show you what his writing looks like. Fortunately, translators don't have to deal with manuscripts these days, and I wouldn't even want to deal with Tolstoy's proofs either, because he did the same thing. You can see he's crossed out a lot here, he's written a lot in the margin, and when the proofs came back, his poor wife, you remember, had to copy all his works out several times. He would go through the proof and hash everything out and want to start again. So he was a fairly chaotic writer, and there's evidence of some sort of chaotic methods in the writing of Anna Karenina too. The novel, of course, like most Russian literature in the 19th century, came out serially. This is the Oxford Slavonic Library's edition of the journal, so I'm afraid it looks a little bit worse for wear. Ruski Vyestnik, Russian Messenger, the first serial publication, appeared in January 1875, and then that's the first page that you're looking at there. And so it was a while before Russian readers got to actually read the novel in total. And it had a fairly chaotic publication history because Tolstoy was undergoing this sort of spiritual crisis towards the end of the composition, that he fell out with his editor and had to publish the last part separately. Now, as far as translations go, there have been quite a lot, and it's an immensely daunting prospect to get the commission to do a new one. But for a Russian literature scholar like myself, it's a sort of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that you don't turn down. And I was really fortunate to have the chance, while I was translating Chekhov's stories, to write a biography of Chekhov, and I had the same experience with Tolstoy. And that has affected the way I've translated, because my whole inspiration for writing Chekhov's biography came out of the experience of communing with him intimately as his translator, working very, very closely with his prose. And with Anna Karenina, I actually did a draft of half of the novel before I downed tools and then got on with the biography. And when I came back to translating the rest of the novel, my attitude to Tolstoy was really rather different. And when I came to the end of the first draft and started revising, I ended up wanting to retranslate the whole thing. And even today, just coming back to look at a few little texts, I find myself thinking, I'm not sure I couldn't do a bit better with that, actually. Which just goes to show that there's always an evolving process. I think any other translator in the audience will agree that it's never finished, and if you come back to a novel to read it, you'll perceive it in a different way. As a translator, you have that same experience, I think, and my relationship with Tolstoy is one that's changing as well. So this is the list of the first translations of Anna Karenina. The first one was an American by Nathan Haskell Doyle, who called it Anna Karenina in a sort of rather French way. Constance Garnett, of course, did a very famous translation. Constance Garnett was the pioneering translator of Russian literature, a remarkable woman, and her translations have stood the test of time. And then there have been quite a few other American translators, and the one I'm replacing is the almighty Louise Neilman Maud one, which was published almost 100 years ago in 1918. And Louise Neilman Maud were friends of Tolstoy. They both lived in Moscow. Elmer Maud actually worked for a carpet company in Moscow, and when he got to know Tolstoy, abandoned all desire to make money under the influence of Tolstoy's newfound religious views, which crystallized immediately after Tolstoy finished Anna Karenina. And he became a sort of devoted follower of Tolstoy for the rest of his life. But he wasn't a writer. He also wasn't a Russian literature specialist. So although he knew the language, it's not enough to know a language to translate a work of literature. And I hope that my background as a Slavist has something to contribute. And as a writer myself, I hope that also has some bearing on the way I've translated. But the Louise Neilman Maud translation has been a sort of benchmark for a very long time. It's been revised a few times. There were quite a few holes in it. Other more recent ones, there's the Rosemary Edwin's translation for Penguin, which has since been superseded, and the Joel Carmichael translation has been quite well respected as well. But more recently, there are two translations which I suppose I'm going into direct competition with, the translation by Richard Pevere and Larisa Volokhonsky, very high profile team who have translated a lot of Russian literature. And then the most recent translation is by Kirill Zinoviev and Jenny Hughes. And Kirill Zinoviev, I think, is 104 this year. He's a remarkable man who actually lived in St. Petersburg before the revolution, and he's blind now. And his great friend Jenny Hughes learnt the letters of the Cyrillic alphabet to be able to complete the translation that his late wife had started on. And it's a very good translation. I must say it reads very fluently. So mine is going to come out this year. And of course, as luck would have it, there's another translation coming out as well by an American translator called Marion Schwartz with Yale University Press. I haven't seen it. This is a page from Tolstoy's ABC. After he finished War and Peace, he had a bit of a meltdown, if you like. You would do after writing a novel that length. He had this huge commitment to the Russian peasantry, and he actually went from this vast epic of Homeric proportions, War and Peace, to writing little stories for Russian children to learn how to read and write, specifically uneducated peasant children on his estate. And this has an influence on how he writes Anna Karenina, which the translator needs to think about, because he was very concerned to appeal to all sections of the Russian population, not just the educated classes. And it determined also his specific use of Slavonic vocabulary. He was very much opposed to westernization in Russia, so he chooses Russian words wherever possible. And that's something I now can see very clearly in the work of his younger contemporary Chekhov as well. So he spent years, poured great love into producing this ABC book, the Azbuka. And you can see the letters of the Cyrillic alphabet there. And he's gone through every single letter, Anya, Banya, Vanya, Gasha, Dasha. And it's actually a very moving book that is still used in its revised version by Russian children today. So he wrote all kinds of little stories, wanting to instill in these young kids a love of the Russian language. When we come to Tolstoy's own language, despite the fact that he wanted to be very simple and to use clear language, actually his style is tremendously hard. And I think he is probably one of the most difficult writers to translate well into English, if you want to be faithful to him and also write in an English that is idiomatic. And that's always the battle a translator has, being faithful and yet somehow writing something that's fluent in your own language. So these are just a couple of comments by Russian writers. Bunin says about Tolstoy's writings that, you know, it's very plain. He doesn't go in for anything sort of flowery or artistic. He is very, very simple in terms of his language. And indeed, the Russian that he uses is really the Russian that we read today. So he doesn't go in for too much decoration, and it's the opposite of anything sort of aesthetic, really. Chekhov's friend in Yalta, Sergei Shukin, remembers him saying this about Tolstoy's language: enormous sentences, one clause piled on top of another. Don't think it's accidental that it's a flaw. It's art, and it's achieved through, sorry about the double it there, through hard work. These sentences produce an impression of strength. And really, that's one of the issues you get with translating Tolstoy, that translators want to sort of improve on the original. Tolstoy is someone who knows what he's doing, but it can seem to an English-speaking reader quite strange. There's an awful lot of repetition, for example, which I shall go into. Chekhov read Tolstoy very attentively. It's been really interesting for me to have some experience of translating both of them, because I think Chekhov learned an awful lot from Tolstoy, even though he was, in a way, to go head-to-head with Tolstoy and to become a very, very different writer. And then in my work as a biographer of Tolstoy, I came to see him as someone who rebelled against absolutely everything, didn't want to submit to any kind of authority. And Yuri Alyesha, I think, puts it very well. He has a whole paragraph in his notebooks about how Tolstoy sort of bends grammatical rules. And he says, you know, even his style is a rebellion against conventions. So that makes it difficult to contend with as prose. And I'll just show you now, we'll home in some details, some examples. So there's a part of Anna Karenina in the earlier part of the novel, in part two, and I suspect most of you have read Anna Karenina. It's the point of the novel where poor old Levin has been spurned by Kitty, and he goes back to his country estate. and he's down in the dumps, and yet spring appears. And one of the things I was surprised by is how lyrical Tolstoy is when he's writing about nature. I found that the most beautiful writing. This is not where the lyricism... the lyricism is not where you'd expect to find it in the sort of romantic scenes between Vronsky and Anna. They're sometimes dealt with in a very gruesome way. But in these particular passages, describing here, for example, the appearance of spring, he's really coming into his own. And this is one of his very long sentences. It's 102 words. That's a long sentence. He's thought about that. And I'm going to try and read it to you, because actually it's hard to translate something like that. And I wanted for the translation to read so that you could more or less read it out aloud, but it does pose some challenges. It was that time of the year, the turning point of summer, when the harvest of the current year can already be counted on, when thoughts turn to the sowing of next year's crops and mowing is at hand, when the rye has come into ear and its grey-green, unripe and still light ears are swaying in the breeze, when green oats are shooting up unevenly in late-sown fields amongst odd clumps of yellow grass, when the leaves of early buckwheat are already spreading out and covering the soil, when the fallow fields, trampled hard as rock by the cattle, with tracks too deep for the plough, have been turned over to the midway point, when the dried-out clumps of carted manure and sweet honey leaf give off a scent at dawn, and the protected lowland meadows with their blackened heaps of weeded sorrel stalks stand like an unbroken sea awaiting the scythe. It was exhausting to get through that one sentence. And that is very, very typical for Tolstoy's style. There are a lot of long sentences, and he tends to want to sort of pack things in. So he uses a lot of parts of speech in Russian which work fine in Russian, which are a nightmare in English, participles and gerunds. So he'll want to have sometimes five different adjectives in one sentence, all in a row. And you can do it in Russian. You can change the words around like you can in Latin. And it's hard to do it in an attractive way in English without sort of smoothing it over, which you don't want to do because you want to be accurate. This is another example of a long sentence. This one's just 96 words. And this is a sentence which is followed by, prefaced by a few shorter ones. And this is also quite typical for Tolstoy. He's got sentences of increasing length. Levin arrived at the club when it was at its busiest. So this is towards the end of the novel when Kitty's about to give birth to their son. And they're in Moscow, and he's twiddling his thumbs and wanting to go home and get back to working on the estate. So he's going to the club one evening. So guests and members were driving up at the same time as him. Levin had not been to the club in a very long while, not since when he was living in Moscow after leaving university and going into society. He remembered the club and the external details of its layout, but he'd completely forgotten the atmosphere he used to experience in the club. And then there's this huge long sentence. And this is a very good example of the use of these past passive participles, which are used in an adjectival way in Russian. But as soon as he stepped into the porch after driving into the spacious semicircular courtyard and getting out of the cab, and a porter in a shoulder belt had noiselessly opened the door for him and bowed, as soon as he caught sight in the porter's lodge of the galoshes and fur coats of members who realised it would be less trouble to remove their galoshes downstairs rather than go upstairs in them, as soon as he heard the mysterious bell which preceded him, and as he went up the shallow carpeted steps, saw on the landing the statue and the familiar aged third porter in club livery in the doorway upstairs, promptly but unhurriedly opening the door and inspecting the new guest, Levin was enveloped in the old atmosphere of the club, an atmosphere of relaxation, contentment and decorum. And the reader also relaxes when they get to the end of that very long sentence. And this is why translating Tolstoy is difficult, and more difficult than, say, Chekhov, who in his story, the Gooseberries, Krizhovnik of 1898, also echoes Tolstoy with these long sentences. And I couldn't help but think of this particular passage from Gooseberries when I was translating Anna Karenina. And here you've got one little short sentence and then a very long one. Only when they'd lit the lamp in the large drawing room upstairs and Birkin and Ivanich were sitting in armchairs dressed in silk robes and warm shoes, and Dolyakin was walking about the room freshly washed and with his hair brushed in a new frock coat, clearly enjoying the feeling of being warm and clean and wearing dry clothes and light shoes. And the beauty, I mean, you know, same thing really. We've got this sort of build-up in which the writer is giving us a picture of what's going on and describing the action and packing it into one sentence. And then finally, then the story begins and the reader can relax. There's a sort of link there, I think. And Chekhov also has these long sentences, but he's a little bit more graceful. It's the difference between a composer of symphonies and a composer of quartets. Chekhov's so much more delicate. And this is a sentence right at the end. It's the last sentence of his famous story, The Student, which he said was his favourite story. And it's all about a student who loses his religious faith. He's a seminary student. It's Good Friday, and he's gone shooting, which he's not supposed to do on Good Friday, and he's coming home. And there's this sort of feeling of drawing breath and coming back to his faith as he comes home. And so that's a way in which Chekhov matches the form with the content. He wants to have this all of one one phrase. Когда он переправлялся на пароме через реку и потом, поднимаясь на гору, глядел на свою родную деревню и на запад, где узкой полосой светилась холодная багровая заря, то думал о том, что правда и красота, направлявшая человеческую жизнь там, в саду и дворе первосвященника, продолжались непрерывно до сего дня и, по-видимому, всегда составляли главное в человеческой жизни и вообще на земле. И чувство молодости, здоровья, силы, ему было только 22 года, и невыразимо сладкое ожидание счастья, неведомого таинственного счастья, овладевали им мало-помалу, и жизнь казалась ему восхитительной, чудесной и полной высокого смысла. So you can see Chekhov sort of taking that Tolstoyan example and doing something of his own with it. And I'm just going to touch on two more little aspects of Chekhov before taking some other details from Anna Karenina. Chekhov also is different to Tolstoy in that he has a rhythm to his prose. And in that same story, Gooseberries, this is the first paragraph, he's divided that first paragraph into four sentences of differing lengths. And he does this on a systematic basis. And the word music is relevant to translating Chekhov in particular. I see him as a very musical writer. And indeed, I was inspired in my approach to translating Chekhov by Shostakovich and Tchaikovsky, who saw deep musicality in his writing. And you need to, as a translator, observe the way in which Tolstoy and Chekhov put together the building blocks of their prose, but particularly with Chekhov, who is building up sort of musical phrases here. And if you look at the different ways in which translators down the years have tackled that paragraph, you can see there's a huge variation, and it does affect the way you read something, whether you read it to yourself or whether you read it aloud. So with the Chekhov, you've got four sentences and 145 words and 19 punctuation marks. And at the other extreme, you've got Ronald Hingley, who was a great British Chekhov scholar, but I think had a different take on Chekhov to me. He has doubled the number of sentences, so he's completely gone against the original. And he's reduced the number of punctuation marks by a half as well. And punctuation, Chekhov said in the letter, plays the part of notes in a musical score. And so I have looked at punctuation very, very carefully with Chekhov, also with Tolstoy. And if you take this paragraph from the same story, Gooseberries, which is the last page, and take out the words and just leave the punctuation, you get this beautiful little pattern with Chekhov. And if you look at Ronald Hingley's version, you can see it looks quite different. So the way in which the sentences are put together, the rhythm that's created is a very different one. Quite how closely you can create an equivalent in English to the Russian one remains to be seen. But I, as a translator, am always looking for the feel of the language as much as accuracy of words. I want to sort of convey a sense of the flow. So Chekhov wrote something called The Letter in the late 1880s, where he has a character talking about a writer, and I think it's so clear that he's talking about Tolstoy here. It's a wonderful thing to say about Tolstoy's style. Between the lines as you read, you see a soaring eagle who is little concerned with the beauty of his feathers. Thought and beauty, like hurricanes and waves, should not pander to usual conventional forms. I think Chekhov was very concerned with the beauty of his feathers, but Tolstoy was indeed this great eagle. I think Chekhov was more like a sort of nightingale, really. But I think it says a lot about who Tolstoy was as a writer stylistically. Now, I want to just draw your attention to two little passages from Anna Karenina and show how they have been translated. We're going to go into the apiary in Anna Karenina, also in part two. And this is Chekhov's friend Levitan's painting of a Russian apiary. You can see that the hives actually look rather different to Western hives. And indeed, they were very different in the 19th century. This is one little sentence in part two, from that same part when spring is appearing in the countryside for Levin on his estate. And it's a sentence which gave me a lot of thought, because I couldn't quite work out what the two words in bold meant. And Tolstoy is talking about everything coming to life, including on the willows, and there's something to do with bees here. И напсыпанной золотым светом лазинья загудела выставленная облетавшаяся пчела. And this is the literal translation. And on the sprinkled with gold light willow began to buzz. And then I've got two question marks for those two words, one of which is a past passive participle used as an adjective, and the other one is a past gerund, so it's a verb, and then B. And if you look at the translations of this sentence in English, you can see there's wide variation. And I use this as an example of how translations can differ. So Constance Garnett has, an exploring bee was humming about the golden blossoms that studded the willow. In the Maud's version, we have, among golden catkins and on the willow branches, the bees began to hum. Rosemary Edmonds, middle of the 20th century, writes, the honeybee hummed among the golden catkins of the willow. So there are three distinct variations there. Let's look at two more, the most recent translations, Pavir and Volokhonsky. And on the willow, all sprinkled with golden catkins, the flitting, newly hatched bee buzzed. And Zinoviev, an old bee pushed out of its hive buzzed in the gold-flecked willow. So what are we dealing with here? A newly hatched bee? An old bee pushed out of its hive? I happened to be at a conference on Tolstoy in 2010, and I sat next to an American scholar who just happened to be writing an article about Tolstoy and bees, amazingly enough. And I said, well, I've been puzzled about this particular sentence, because these two words, you know, I looked up in a 19th century glossary of beekeeping terminology, and I think I've got it right. You know, could you just confirm that? And I knew, because I'd written this biography of Tolstoy, that Tolstoy had this mad passion for beekeeping in the early 1860s when he was writing War and Peace. And I just had a hunch that these two words, which looked familiar but weren't totally clear had something to do with beekeeping. And indeed that was the case. So these words, one of them, Выставленная. Выставка in Russian means exhibition. It means putting out, literally. So something has been put out. Облетавшая, so it's the verb to fly, летать, with the prefix об, which means around. So something's flying around. And what it actually means is that the hives, which have been inside for the winter, because it's Russia and it's very cold, have been moved for the summer because it's spring. And there's a special day, Sasima's and Savati's day, you bring your hives out. And the bees go on their first flight from the hive. So it's nothing to do with an old bee or a new bee, just the fact that the hives have been moved. And then you have a different challenge, which is to how to render that in English in a very, very neat way. I wrote to the organiser of the conference on Tolstoy in Italy to share that, you know, what a serendipitous find it was to meet someone who could confirm that I basically, my hunch was correct. And she went to her shelf and picked up the new Italian translation of Anna Karenina, which is un'ape abbandonata che girovali attorno, which is an abandoned bee, which is absolutely hopeless because that's not true at all. And this is what I'll get to my translation in a minute. I managed to find a solution. But in the meantime, I've been in correspondence with the editor of Beekeepers Quarterly and had a really lively correspondence. And in fact, if you want to read more about this, you'll have to subscribe to Beekeepers Quarterly, where I'm about to publish an article. And he wrote to me, John Phipps, he's a very nice man. He said, well, newly hatched, definitely wrong, because a larva hatches from an egg and a bee emerges from its cell. And an old bee, of course, is never pushed out of the hive and certainly not to go foraging. And so I got all this information about bee behaviour, which I found absolutely fascinating. And bees were absolutely of central importance to Tolstoy. Of course, if you think about War and Peace, there's that famous simile. So this is what I came up with in the end. Bees on the first spring flight from their new home started buzzing about the gold-flecked willows. Not ideal, but it does actually convey what Tolstoy had in mind. And if you think that perhaps that kind of detail happens on a many, many, many other pages, that's why I think there's still room for a new translation of Anna Karenina. One other example comes up in part six, and this is when Levin goes hunting or shooting for birds with Oblonsky, Stepan Arkadyevich. And Stepan Arkadyevich is wearing something particular. He's wearing poroshni and podvyotki. And Tolstoy, loving the Russian land, loving the Russian peasantry, he has two words which are part of Russian peasant clothing. They're to do with shoes and leggings. And he's used it in an earlier story where he thinks there's something really, really Russian about it. Podvyotki, paruski, he says in the tree felling. So Constance Garnett has Stepan Arkadyevich dressed in rough leggings and spats to go shooting. They're in the countryside, they're going on the marshes, they're going to be shooting snipe. Now, spats are, for me, these are these spats. They're the sort of early 19th century abbreviation of spatterdash. Probably not ideal if you're going to be tromping around the bogs in the Russian countryside. And I don't think typically a Russian gentleman would wear cloth gaiters, these sort of they're rough leggings that she's got. So rough leggings and spats, well, that's one version. The Mauds have rawhide shoes. So are we talking about something on the far left there? Or are we talking about brogues, which Pavir and Volokhonsky have? They've got brogues and leggings. And I looked up brogues, and they're quite right, because the original meaning of brogues is a shoe of untanned leather, as I've put in the definition here, worn in parts of Ireland and the Scottish Highlands. So those are brogues. But I think most people would think of the perforated smart shoes before they'd think of that. And so I don't think Oblonsky would be wearing that either to go hunting for snipe. So Norvieff and Hughes have him wearing puttees and rawhide shoes, which is a little bit colonial, and that really is a sort of Britishism. So puttees, they're this long strip of cloth wound around the leg. That is actually much, much closer to what Oblonsky's wearing. But in fact, what he's wearing are these sort of simple moccasin types made out of one piece of leather. And of course, moccasin is a loaded word too. We associate that with the Native Americans. And yet, I think the word can survive that if you have a qualifier like light peasant moccasins. Because the reason Oblonsky wears them, he wants light shoes. He doesn't want the birds to hear him clomping around. He also wants the footwear to dry out quickly. And that's why he's wearing these very simple footwear. And he's wearing typical foot bindings too, such as the Russian soldiers still wear today, I think. And he's one of these sort of inverted snobs. So the party consists of Levin and this sort of nouveau riche Russian who comes as if he's just been to Harrods and he's just bought the smartest kit, you know, Ralph Lauren shooting gear. But Oblonsky comes from the old world aristocracy. He's going to be wearing, you know, stuff that works. So he's got a really good gun, but his clothes are really tatty. And these are appropriate. So I think it's also important in this little detail to get every element of his clothing right. And that's how you would make those shoes. And that's an example of them. This is what he's got on his feet, I think. And you see numerous Russian peasants wearing these leggings. And you see that in a lot of 19th century paintings. Now, I have to finish in a minute. Just a few things I might mention that are important for a translator to think about. The Mauds anglicised all the Russian names in Anna Karenina in their translation, and I felt it was important to keep the Russian versions. And in fact, the way in which Tolstoy refers to his characters is a form of characterisation in itself, because you have, for example, Oblonsky, you've got Stepan Arkadyevich, you've got Stepan Arkadych. There are lots of diminutives, and they are very important in defining our relationship with the characters. I've talked about the specialist vocabulary. You need to be sensitive to the very different registers that you find in this novel. There's quite a lot of irony in it. There's some satire. There's quite a lot of bureaucratic lexicon for characters like Karenin, which you need to convey in an accurate way. And then there are all the repetitions, which a lot of earlier translations ironed out, such as the words which come from the word vesela, which means sort of jolly, light-hearted. I counted 318 times this word is used in its versions in the novel, and in one particular chapter it's used 9 times. And you face a difficult choice there. You can use the same word, but I think Russian functions in a different way to English. English is a language where there are sort of minute gradations of texture, and sometimes it behoves you as a translator to actually think about different ways of varying that particular word. But there are some times when you need to be very faithful to the original. And this is the first page of the novel, the famous first page. And this is one of those cases where you need to stick to what's there. You've got in highlight there, in bold, the word and variations of the word for house or home, dom. And Nabokov said wonderfully in his article that it's like a sort of bell tolling, that everything's confusion in the Blonsky house. And Tolstoy is deliberately repeating the word house and variations of it because everything has been turned upside down. There it is in English. But it's a hard thing to do because domochadtsy, meaning household or servants, is a difficult one to convey, and you can't do it absolutely 100% some of the time. So I've managed to repeat a lot of the usages of Dom, but not all of them. And that brings me pretty much to the end. There are lots of words I've left in the Russian, like Zemstvo, which we sort of know in English. I've used Dacha as well, which I think we understand. And then there are various other Russian words, which I don't like Muzhik. I've used peasant there. And these are some of the Russian words that you meet a lot in the text, words like dusha, soul, krasnet, to blush. And I've tried to find wonderful English words that not necessarily would come up in a dictionary to render some of those very fine gradations of meaning. Words like lackadaisical and crestfallen, because our language is so much richer in that respect with these sort of very precise meanings. And my final slide is of a portrait which has been chosen for the cover of my new edition. And that's a whole area of discussion in itself, how you you illustrate a translation, and whether you, in the case of Anna Karenina, have a woman on the front of it or not. I'll leave it to you to think about whether you think that's a good choice for Anna. Thank you. Okay.
The Australian reader might read the Mockies and have a laugh, but what I was interested in was your determination to keep the syntax and the length of the sentences is really admirable, and especially in view of this kind of plain English movement, that there's always pressure to kind of simplify and reduce and split sentences from languages like Russian and so forth. I was wondering, had you been under any pressure, do you ever feel any pressure of simplification, of abandoning that kind of brief to really reproduce the quality of the Russian in that way? Because often the common wisdom is to split the sentences or put something accessible, or There are lots of ways that English is purported to be, whereas English is probably a lot richer than it's given credit for, but there's this kind of movement to the simplification. Do you ever feel a pressure for that to keep the English?
Only self-imposed, I would say. I think, yeah. I was a lot more cavalier as a translator of Tolstoy when I started out. And I thought, oh, well, you know, it's time we had a much freer interpretation of Anna Karenina. And after I finished writing his life, I was much more reverential, actually. And I felt it was my duty to try and render his music in English in as faithful a way as possible. And it's the sense, the feeling of his prose. I think that's absolutely important. So in that case, you do need to think about these tiny things and not simplify. It ruins it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like, you know, clapping before a piece of music's finished, isn't it? You need to think about the whole.
That's right. Yeah. So, was there a period when that sort of tendency to go back to the simplification that you're obviously steering a balance as you translate and thinking about it all the time, bearing that in mind. But is there a kind of history of the translations of Tolstoy that shows there's a time when it's really sort of explaining it for English speakers rather than conveying the style of the Russian exotic period?
Well, I think the earlier translators, Constance Garnett, for example, smooth things over, and the Mauds do that as well. But that was at a time when people thought that's how you should translate, and Russian would have been very, very foreign to English-speaking readers in the early years of the 20th century. It's not now, and people can cope with it, I think, a lot better. At the same time, I'm less faithful than Pavirin Volokhonsky, who I don't feel go far enough into producing a work of prose in its own right that can sort of stand on its own. They're so faithful to the rhythms of Russian that actually you need to think about your own language as well. They're a little bit too literal.
Thank you very much for that. It was thoroughly enjoyable, and I'm very much looking forward to the translation. But as far as my questions, really, one is, were you drawn to ponder when you were doing the translation of Anna Karenina on the shortage of Christian names, which is really extraordinary, because not only is that Anna, but she has a maid called Anushka. She takes in a little English girl called Hannah. But the really important thing, which is the question, is that when she has a little girl with Vronsky, she's called Annie. And the more expensive that is Annie, or A-W-N-I-E. And Rosemary Edmund certainly has A-N-I, so it's Russian. But it does has always seemed to me that those spellings are not innocent, because of the constant, many references in Anna Karenina to the English way of doing things. This is very distinct from the Russian way. So that was one question that I'd like you to comment on. And the other one is just that because I've been writing a review of an American book for the Russian review, I'm rather surprised to see that the writer of the book is quite convinced that Yev is Norman. And I know that, but I would like to hear your comment on that, please.
Yeah, I'll begin with that one. I remember as a student in a Russian emigre community in Paris, listening to someone telling me, it's Lyovin. And I was surprised by that. And we know that Tolstoy at home, wasn't he? He was called Lyovra. But I still think it's Lyovin. I much prefer it. So, and in my notes, I explain that the jury is basically out, because there is a recent article in the Tolstoy Studies Journal which goes into this very question of whether it's Lyovin or Lyevin. And for those of you who don't know Russian, L-E-V-I-N can be L-E with a sort of umlaut on it, which makes it Yo. So that's the same with Gorbachev, for example. That's the same Yo there. So I think there's a body of opinion which believes it was definitely Lyovin, and there's still another 50% of the reading population who think it's Lyovin, and you can argue the case either way. And if you think it's Lyovin, then I'm glad to hear that. And you're quite right about the names. I mean, funnily enough, in Russian anyway, there are far fewer first names than there are in English. And with Anna Karenina, there is an English theme running all the way through the novel. There's a French theme, and by and large, they're sort of pejorative, aren't they, as opposed to the Russian one. So that's one reason why we should not anglicise the names, because you do need to have the little girl Annie, A-N-N-I-E, because it is deliberately an English name. So it's spelled A-N-I in Russian, yeah. But they meant Annie. And the same is true for Kitty as well. because all the characters have these English, so Dolly and Kitty. So in the Russian it's K-I-T-I, but you can't spell that all the way through the novel. It's not just the girls' names, it's the boys' names, because Karenin and Vronsky have the same first name too, don't they? And there's something going on with what Tolstoy is trying to do. And I must say, when I used to teach Anna Karenina, I mean, I'm ashamed of my ignorance. I got very tired of the sort of didactic message of the novel, which is definitely there. And it's only through translating it and poring over the very rich literature of secondary texts, including, if I'm right, you're Judith Armstrong, you wrote a wonderful book yourself about the novel, that I've come to, you know, come back to the novel with great humility, because it's incredibly sophisticated beneath. There's so many things going on, aren't there? And they're not spelt out, actually. So the names are very important. They're a form of characterization. They're part of Tolstoy's strategy for passing comment about, you know, wicked English influences, wicked French influences, to put it very crudely.
The figure of Anna itself, you know, being broadly interpreted as sort of like a proto-feminist heroine on one hand, and on the other, and something like that's much closer to the mark as a woman who's in love with being loved and then has no meaning in her life when that's gone. Did you have a take on that? And if so, how did it influence your translation? Have you put your colours on the mast a bit in this choice of colour?
I didn't choose this portrait, by the way. This was my editor's choice. I had a different idea for the cover, which the sales and marketing department predictably didn't go for. my take on Anna as someone who...
What, well, is she a proto-feminist or someone who's in love?
Well, actually, this is actually rather a good portrait. And I've come round to thinking this, if you're going to have a woman on the cover, and I didn't want to have a woman on the cover, I think it's very sort of reductive. I think it's a very good choice because, and I've just been giving talks at the New South Wales Art Gallery these last few works about movements in art in the late 19th century, and I found myself, I mean, this came through the email in the middle of the night from England, and I was just preparing a lecture on the Grosvenor Gallery and discovered that this actual portrait was portrayed there, and I could work it into my lecture, and I did a bit of research into Louise Jopling and discovered she was a remarkable woman. And she actually had the life that Anna couldn't have. And I think there's an awful... there's a very good case for arguing Anna as a kind of proto-feminist, because she did have the potential to live a fulfilled life. And in the very rigid circumstances of late 19th century Russia, she couldn't. Whereas in much more sort of permissive conditions of England, here is... a similarly sort of feisty young woman who wants to have her own life, and she has to fight for it. She has a jolly difficult life, but she gets to establish her own school for painting, and is sort of, you know, writing essays for women's equality. So, but I think it makes Tolstoy's character very interesting, that she has all these qualities, but she's got a lot of flaws in her character as well, which may have to do with Tolstoy's misogynist views, but she doesn't quite carry it through, and increasingly towards the end of the novel, she's sort of very focused in on herself and very self-absorbed. She doesn't want to look at reality in the face, and it's a big topic, that one, actually. I don't know if I've nailed my colours to the mast in my portrayal in as a translator. I hope not. I hope I've retain some objectivity.
I really love your commitment to the integrity of the line, and that you've got 91 word sentences, and you know that you haven't adapted them. And I thought that one particular one with the flowing images, one after the other, after the other, after the other, which ends up with the field of unsighted corn, whatever it was.
Oh, thank you. It's very beautiful writing. I mean, those are all the pages that people turn over really quickly. I did when I was a teenager. You know, you want to get onto the Anna and Vronsky bit, and that's boring. But as a translator, actually, I found I was very, very inspired by the beauty of Tolstoy's writing, and it's very crude, not crude, it's very unvarnished way. How he conveys beauty without resorting to sort of literary devices is his great achievement and his great genius, isn't it?
Yeah, well, just the images themselves.
Yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. And as far as I can see your presentation, my question will be about literary translation, not about Tolstoy now. As far as I can see, translation is not only linguistic competence. And apart from being a person, a bilingual person with knowledge of Russian and English literature, I want to ask about the competence. What else represents the competencies of a literary translator? From your point of view?
From my point of view, I think
I can see that apart from literature and linguistic competence, research competence, for example, from what you have done here, is dominant here. What else I want to learn about your competence?
For me, the most important thing is knowing the culture. You need to know the language really well, but I've spent a lot of time in Russia, and I've got to know a lot of Russians, and I love the Russian language, and I've got a lot of Russian friends, and to have some understanding of how the Russian mentality works, I think is key for understanding the literature and being prepared to convey it in another language. I think that's important. I don't know that the scholarly knowledge is imperative, but it certainly does come in useful when you're doing research into when you can sort of see that suddenly you're dealing with a word that comes from a different linguistic register, for example. But mostly, I think probably knowing the culture and knowing the milieu that a writer comes from as well.
Sorry, I was just wondering, have you found in any way that Tolstoy's work has had an impact on the Russian language, like the structure of the Russian language, or, I don't know, just linguistically in any way, quotes, phrases, things like that that pop up, that Tolstoy has had an influence on the language, say, for example, like Shakespeare's.
Yeah, he's been a sort of towering presence in Russian letters. I mean, he still is today. For all contemporary writers, they all want to write like Tolstoy, because he was able to write in this manner which is sort of at once very immediate and also very universal. And he was the model for all Soviet writers in the early 20th century too. In terms of actual specific phrases, the beginning sentence of the novel, everything, you know, all families are alike, and, you know, happy families are alike, that is something which is not just used in Russian, but, you know, all over the world now, isn't it? It's very popular. I can't think offhand of any other examples, but because he uses such sort of simple locutions. I mean, I hope I've showed how his language and style had an impact on Chekhov, who regarded him as, you know, the sort of father figure, but otherwise.
Sorry, just the fact that you mentioned Chekhov as well. When you were sort of say, jumping between sort of Chekhov and going back to Tolstoy, do you Do you think that perhaps the voice of one had an influence on the voice of the other whilst you were translating? I know that you said that obviously Tolstoy had an impact on Chekhov's writing. Do you think, in a way, having read Chekhov's work, I mean, you did say that it had an impact on what you went back to read Tolstoy, but in terms of translating, do you think that maybe one of the reasons why you sort of started to revise your translations was because of having read the other?
Yeah, very much so. And I'm hoping to go back to translating more Chekhov now. He's my sort of number one writer. And I think already my attitude towards his prose is different, having engaged so much with Tolstoy. I mean, over such a long period of time and so intensely. I mean, it'll be a bit of a relief to come back to Chekhov. But I can't help but see him in a different way now, because I can sort of see Tolstoy in there. Two writers. Oh, yes, definitely Chekhov, I'm afraid. Yeah, sorry, I'm completely committed. Yeah.
I was just wondering, translating such a classic, how much the previous English translations influenced you as you were working on it, and possibly being so familiar with growing up with the English works, or if you read the Russian first, or and even as you were working on it, if you referred back to them, or if you tried not to.
Yeah, very, very good question. I read it in English to begin with. My Russian wasn't good enough for a long time, and the translations that are in print are really good, actually. But I suppose if you get the job of translating something, you want to do a better job, don't you? I actually did work with all the other translations and not always found something better. But more often than not, I sort of wanted to do my own thing, not just because I wanted to be different, but because I felt that there was a better way of doing it that turned out to be, yeah, slightly different. And there is, I think, much more variation between the different translations than you might think, and I was quite surprised when I was going through to see how extreme that was in some places. So yes, I did take account of them. In this case with Chekhov, I perhaps foolishly didn't. I worked on my own, but I found that I nearly always had my own version of something, which is good, because there's always going to be room for more translations. And I mean, my translation hasn't even been published yet, but it'll be superseded, you know, in a couple of decades too. But that's just in the way of things, isn't it? And it's a good thing. I would never want to claim that, you know, I've produced the definitive translation, in the way that you can never claim as a musician to produce the definitive performance of a work. There's always going to be new life that you can breathe into a work.
One more question, I think.
It's just a comment on the beautiful portrait, which I respond to very positively, but I just wondered whether you have asked Russians in terms of how they respond to this particular image.
No, because this has only just been chosen by my publisher, and you know, you're the first to see it. Actually, it hasn't even been put together as a cover yet. And I think the one great advantage of this portrait is that it's not a portrait of a Russian woman, because invariably the old translations of Anna Karenina have a Russian painter's version of a Russian woman, and I think that's really dull. I actually wanted to have a painting by Levitan which had a train going through a landscape. It's a beautiful painting, which I might be able to even show you, actually. Do you want to see it? I see if I can find it. But it was just a bit too subtle, really. And sales and marketing, is, you know, they always win the battle, don't they? I'll just see if I can find it. I'll just take the thing off. It won't take me a minute. So I don't know how Russians will... Are there any Russians here? No Russians who can comment on that. Let's see if I can just find that. It'd be rather good to... No, I'm going to put it back in again. I just... want to prolong. Yeah, there it is. Okay, let's see. Might be difficult. Do you want to sort of wrap up, and I'll see if I can find it so that you wanted to finish, didn't you?
But
I don't want to hold people up here.
Well, I'll wrap up then. thanks to the London University Asia Institute for allowing us to use this very fine venue. Thanks to Elaine Lewis. Thanks most of all to our two speakers for those really entertaining yeah. presentations, and there it is.
The train plays such a big role in the novel, and I just thought it was. It also sort of brought the other half of the novel, which gets cut off, which is the Levin side, because of the countryside. And I like to see the novel as sort of, you know, offering hope rather than closing in, which is what you have with The Portrait of a Woman, and this one you've got all that lovely sky, but never mind.
Thank you very much.